Welcome to Statewide, reports and conversations from in and around Illinois. I'm Sean Crawford. Today we look at gun violence from the point of view of the survivors and how they live with the trauma. We'll also hear about the Fully Free campaign, an effort to end what it refers to as permanent punishments for convicted felons. Cases of COVID-19 have spiked again. There are worries about the rapid rise of the Delta variant, but some are still hesitant to get the vaccine.
It doesn't stop you from getting it. It doesn't stop you from spreading it.
So until it's more healthier, I feel like it's better just to wait until it's FDA approved.
We'll hear from some residents about how they view the pandemic. Teaching over the past year has been a challenge, and a lot of teachers say they need a break. We'll hear how they've tried to recharge over the summer. And we'll also get the story of how Illinois became a state. Those stories and more this hour on Statewide. This is Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. Coming up this hour, the spread of the Delta variant of COVID-19 has caused cases to go up. Now the state has a new mask mandate for schools. There are also new details about just how contagious this new variant is. We'll hear from some Illinois residents about the current situation and how they feel about it. Bringing more broadband service to rural areas, it's not going to be easy, and we'll hear why. Also, how Illinois became a state more than 200 years ago. And here's a spoiler, there was some deception involved. That's all ahead on Statewide. There's been a lot of focus on gun violence in Chicago. This year has seen shootings go up. We often think of the violence in terms of murders, but that actually minimizes the problem. For every person killed in a Chicago shooting, five are shot and survive. And those victims, about 50,000 since the year 2000, are marked for life. Patrick Smith talked to one survivor about how he's coping.
Joseph Williams has been at both ends of the gun.
You know, you feel the power of it, and then you feel the respect. You pull a gun on somebody, their whole attitude changed.
Williams, who everyone calls Joe Wayne, says when he was younger, he was a pretty hardcore gangbanger.
The first time I shot somebody was, I was 14 then.
In 1994, when Williams was 29, he was outside of a bar at the corner of 75th and Halsted, gambling. Shooting dice, and he won big.
It was like $7,500, something like that. Then went in the club to have some drinks and just, you know, do what we do.
When he came out of the bar, drunk and happy, he got ambushed.
The guys that I was gambling with had called some more people to come stick me up. They hit me three times in the side. Then when I fell up, they walked up to me and shot me three times in the back. And then when they turned me over, I just laid there like I was dead. And they just took all the gold off my neck, went in my pockets, took all my rings off, and left me there for dead.
It took Williams 3 years to recover physically from the six bullet wounds. A lot of that recovery time he spent in jail, because when he got shot, he was carrying an illegal gun. He remembers waking up in the hospital, handcuffed to the bed.
The shock had went off, and I could feel the bullets in me. And I couldn't move, but it was just steaming. Hot, you know, like I was on fire.
While he was recovering in jail, Williams thought hard about the life he was leading, the danger he was in, the people he had hurt.
And I was like, man, I could have been dead. You know, I should have been dead. And I say, I need to do something different.
He resolved to change his life once he was out. But then, back on the street, the trauma he suffered actually made it harder for him to change his life. He was afraid.
Now, everybody know that you can... You ain't that steel that you was, so anybody might try to pull it on you. You know, they done did it once, they'll do it again.
He decided he had to show the people around him that he was no mark.
I was scared within myself, but I wanted to let them know, let whoever know that I'm still built to do this.
Williams went back to carrying a gun, back to gangbanging. It took almost 20 years for him to get out of that life. He still feels afraid sometimes.
4th of July is my worst holiday, you know. I still feel that effect, you know. Every time I hear something loud, you know, I'm looking, you know. It ain't never no comfortable feeling.
Williams is one of tens of thousands of people in Chicago living with the trauma and pain of a gunshot wound. Since the turn of the millennium, about 50,000 people have survived gunshots in Chicago. It's a population that would make up a city unto itself, all of its citizens marked for life. Dr. Tanya Zacherson moved to the United States from Canada because of all the shooting. Zacherson is a trauma surgeon at the University of Chicago.
It attracts actually surgeons from around the world to work here. That's the volume of gun violence.
On a busy night, Zacherson and her colleagues treat 20 to 25 gunshot victims at the U of C Trauma Center.
Sadly, you feel like you're working in a war zone. So you're using your clinical skills and your operative skills the way you were trained to do so.
Zacherson says treating the injuries and recovering from them is especially challenging because of the unique impact bullets have on a human body. Unlike a stab wound, a bullet doesn't just go straight in. There's something called a tumble and yaw of a bullet that surgeons use to describe the way a gunshot bounces around inside the human body, destroying everything in its path.
It can cause so much damage and so much injury. It's really devastating and completely damaging to the patient on an anatomic and physiologic level.
Studies show that shooting survivors experience pain for years after their injuries and frequently have to be readmitted to the hospital long after their initial recovery. The University of Chicago provides wraparound services to the people who come into the trauma center. But Zacherson says overall in Chicago, shooting victims are not getting near the help they need. And it goes beyond the physical. Experts say up to 70% of the people who get shot develop post-traumatic stress disorder, or PTSD.
Trauma changes everything. It disrupts everything.
Sonia Dinizulu runs the University of Chicago's Stress, Trauma, and Resilience Program. The trauma of being shot can change the way people think and perceive things. Many survivors of shootings in Chicago, people who were just caught in the crossfire or hit by a stray bullet, talk about what they should have done to protect themselves from something impossible to predict.
Trauma makes people think that they are to blame.
It also makes it harder for people to hold down jobs, maintain relationships, excel in school. And it can make people feel afraid. For Joe Wayne, his response to that fear was to double down on his gangbanging persona and add to the city's violence, even as he was hoping for a way out. For others, it means not going outside or being wary of strangers or hiding from unfamiliar cars. Dinizulu says these problems are compounded by the fact that the vast majority of shootings happen in poor communities of color, already suffering from disinvestment and a lack of resources.
We just survived a traumatic event. Now we have to survive other systems of trauma that has always been plaguing the Black and brown community for hundreds of years.
She says Chicago survivors need more support, more mental health help, more services for people with physical issues. But they also need help with basic things like food and housing. Most importantly, she says, the city needs to invest in the communities where people are being shot. Prevent shootings. Make it so there are fewer victims of trauma.
This is not normal. This doesn't happen in every single neighborhood in America. It happens in particular neighborhoods with a particular demographic of people.
It doesn't happen in every neighborhood, but it happens across the country. A recent study shows more than 230 people sustain a non-fatal gun injury every day in America. The researchers from the gun safety group Everytown concluded that people wounded by gunfire make up an enormous portion of gun violence, but they have not been an integral part of the conversation about it. They say giving more attention to those who did not die could alter policies and suggest new solutions. Patrick Smith, WBEZ News.
A new group led by formerly incarcerated people in Illinois has launched a campaign to end what it calls permanent punishments for those who have been convicted of felonies. Illinois Newsroom student journalist Vivian Law reports on Fully Free. Jim Meadows asked her what members of the Fully Free campaign told her about the problems they face after being released from prison.
So, for example, trying to find housing after you've gone out of prison without a support system can feel impossible. Marlon Chamberlain, who is the campaign manager for Fully Free, he says that even if someone isn't denied a housing application due to the numerous laws that require background checks, they could be denied because of things like a low credit score, which is hard to maintain when you've been in prison. So there's restrictions that are written into laws like these kinds of housing laws and those that require background checks. There's also stigmas and stereotypes from the communities that they go back to that formerly incarcerated people face, and the fear that these people might have about going back to prison. So for example, this fear could prevent people from reporting like someone rear-ending them because they could risk having the accident blamed on them due to their past conviction. And another smaller example is Chamberlain was unable to chaperone his son's field trip because of his prison record that's over 25 years old. So it ranges from those that are written into law, but then there's also those that are more subtle but still have this impact on people.
Well, what does Fully Free want to change when it comes to these legal restrictions and the stigmas that you mentioned?
It's about dismantling these laws that restrict people, like these background checks, and that Fully Free wants to eliminate. But they're also trying to work with politicians to take away these restrictions and give support and resources to those that are formerly incarcerated. Illinois gives newly released prisoners $100 after release, which is not enough to restart a life. Taking away some of these legal restrictions can help people find opportunities to get their life back together. Another component is education and informing the community about the different problems that these people face, which is what some of the local groups that are partnering with the campaign throughout the state are trying to do.
Now, for your reporting, you spoke with people from those local organizations, and I believe they included a TASC, a treatment alternative for local communities based in the Bloomington Normal area, and First Followers based in Champaign-Urbana. What did people from those groups have to say about why the current policies are unfair?
Yeah, so James Kilgore, who is co-director of First Followers, he says that after you serve your sentence, you should be done. You should be fully free. And Toy Beasley with TASC, he says people deserve the same rights as everyone else after serving a sentence. TASC and First Followers are both reentry programs that provide support systems for those after release. They help individuals with things like applying for a job or even math tutoring to earn a job certificate at Parkland College, which First Followers has done. Kilgore says that a lot of what they do to help people that are formerly incarcerated isn't profound in the sense that it's math tutoring, like these small things that a lot of people normally shouldn't have to get help with, but these programs exist because of the restrictive laws that prevent people from seeking opportunities on their own in the first place.
Well, what challenges do you see as the Fully Free campaign facing in terms of achieving their goals in changing these policies and laws?
Chamberlain, the campaign manager, talked a lot about the Black Lives Matter movement and these kinds of nationwide protests that have been happening in the past year and how Fully Free wouldn't be here today without them, because Black and Brown communities are also disproportionately impacted by mass incarceration. And as a result, they're also impacted more by these laws that restrict those released because of systemic racism. But he said it's really about trying to continue all that momentum from these protests and conversations. But there's also challenges with political polarization. And what they're trying to do to address that is frame this as less of a political issue and more of a human rights issue. They're trying to engage with people that normally aren't part of the conversation. It doesn't matter whether you're Democrat or Republican, as he said, because at the end of the day, it's a human rights issue that hurts communities on many different levels.
That's Illinois Newsroom student journalist Vivian Law talking with Jim Meadows about Fully Free. That's a campaign to end penalties for people convicted of felonies in Illinois that extend beyond their prison sentences. A garden can bring a bounty of vegetables, but one Midwestern garden is doing a lot more, providing a much-needed social outlet for young people. Farah Yousri of Side Effects Public Media has that report.
On the side of a busy parkway in Indianapolis, cars speed past a flood of bright green t-shirts. It's a group of more than 40 high schoolers who gather each morning to work in a vegetable garden. The garden is the size of two basketball courts, and it brims with tomatoes, cabbage, dill weed, and fragrant mint and basil, as well as a few chickens.
None of this stuff was here in 2019. We really just started all of this stuff. They teach you a lot just by working here.
Kenyatta Reed is a 17-year-old with long braided hair and a beaming smile. She's part of a youth program called the Green Team.
For me, it's really the people. It's like, I feel like a second home. It's not really just about work. Like, it's fun to be here. And you get paid to be here, so just double it for me.
The youth get paid as much as $10 an hour. Reed uses that money to help with family bills and to do some shopping for herself. Still, she feels most empowered by the skills and knowledge she learns here.
So here, actually, the marigolds and the basil are protecting the the tomatoes from nematodes in the soil.
Phyllis Boyd is the executive director of Groundwork Indy, the nonprofit that has organized this summer program since 2016. She draws from history and her expertise as a botanical and environmental scientist as she teaches the youth how to grow their own food.
So Native Americans used to approach plantings in this way, where you'd have the squash that would spread on the ground and you know, crowd out the weeds. The corn would grow up, and then it would provide a structure for the beans to grow. And so you'd have these all growing together.
And she makes sure her lessons go way beyond how to pair plants and arrange a garden.
Yeah, and that's one of the things we like to do, is not just have youth involved in the hands-on, you know, like work that's, you know, dirty and heavy, and but actually have them engaged in the process of how you think and dream about spaces and how you can change them, and then work on visioning and then planning and design implementation. And so they get to see the whole arc of like how you as a person can do stuff in the world.
Granted, there's a lot of stuff that needs to be done in this neighborhood. For starters, the green team had to test the soil for lead contamination when they chose this spot for the garden. Lead is a toxin used in some industries and can be found in soil, old house paint, and water. This neighborhood is a hot spot for lead poisoning in children and elevated lead levels. The garden soil was no exception, but the green team had a solution.
You bring lead-free soil in, and you garden with that soil, and that's what you're in contact with, not the soil that's underneath.
Katie Hawthorne, a 22-year-old program supervisor, says outside of this garden, the youth aren't always given the space to try out things and find creative ways to solve problems.
You know, a lot of them are going to my high school, and I know how I struggled while I was there.
She came to the program during a college internship. She has a degree in public health and anthropology from Purdue University. And like many of the youth here, she struggled to find nurturing, safe spaces.
People not letting kids be kids, and when they say that inner city schools are run like prisons, I think that's a very serious statement. The presence of police, it's just a very rigid system that doesn't allow for creativity, doesn't allow for them to make mistakes and learn from them in a valuable way.
She says for the green team, this is a place for hope and respite from a harsh reality. They live day in and day out. For Side Effects Public Media, I'm Farah Yusri.
Well, stay with us. There is more of Statewide on the way. We'll look at efforts to bring broadband to rural areas. That and more coming up. We're back on Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. And coming up, many teachers needed a break after a year of remote learning and other pandemic challenges. We'll hear from some about how they've spent their summer. That and more on the way. Rural areas are some of the last places to get high-speed internet access, and decades ago, they were also the last areas to receive electricity. Back then, the federal government set up cooperatives to help rural residents pay to install poles and lines to every farmhouse. Harvest Public Media's Seth Bodine looks at how bringing broadband to rural communities might be more complicated.
In Okemah, Oklahoma, Wi-Fi hotspots are in demand. The public library got 6 of the T-Mobile internet hookups in 2018. The waitlist was months long before they eventually got more.
It was a constant battle to get people off that waiting list, and we don't have that problem now because we have so many.
She says logging onto the web is important for the town of 3,000. It's not just for kicking it and watching Netflix. Internet access means jobs.
And nowadays, most employers are requesting you fill out online applications for jobs, and that's difficult for people because they didn't have access to it.
For most people in cities, it's just a matter of calling up the local cable or telephone provider. But right now, 1 in 5 people in rural communities like Okemah can't do that, according to the Federal Communications Commission. It's not so different from the situation with electricity nearly a century ago, when it was available in cities, but not small towns or farms. For families, that meant hand-washing clothes and working by the light of a lantern. An old documentary showed how lack of power could hurt a farmer's pocketbook.
hard to cool milk right in August if you haven't the right sort of pump or equipment.
The milk is sour, so the handler gives back cartons and the farmer loses money.
Sour milk, good for pigs, but the milk check won't be so big this month.
The solution to all this? The Rural Electrification Act. It gave low-interest loans to rural communities to form rural electric co-ops. Then they'd set up the electric lines and poles. It'd all be paid off in 30 years through monthly electric bills. Rural broadband faces the same basic challenge as electricity. For-profit companies don't want to invest. Hamid Vahadipur is the CEO of Lake Region Electric Cooperative, which provides broadband.
In rural areas, you can have less than 10 customers for every mile of fiber optics that you have, where in town that number could go as high as 50 or 70 customers per mile. So it is difficult to provide this kind of service.
Bringing broadband to rural areas is more complicated than electricity. One of the reasons, there are already some providers, but they don't always provide truly high-speed access. Co-ops are interested in providing that service, but the cost might be too high even without the need to make a profit. Cooperatives share the cost of building broadband, just like they did when they built electricity. Chris Myers is the general manager of the Oklahoma Association of Rural Electric Cooperatives. He says the bills might be too high for smaller co-ops.
That cost might be $500 a month. Well, I don't know that people can afford that. And that's just a number. But just to break even, the cost would be so high that it'd be a problem.
About $4 billion a year have gone out to telephone companies to get them to expand broadband. Tom Wheeler, the former chair of the FCC, says it didn't work.
It wasn't working because we still have this huge swath of rural America that doesn't have access to broadband.
Instead, Wheeler says building broadband infrastructure needs to be handled more like roads.
Build it once and pay for it and go home. Instead of this trickling out of money to companies that were basically telephone companies in the hope that they would expand and build broadband.
The FCC estimates it would take about $80 billion to bring broadband to every home. Between Biden's proposed infrastructure bill and CARES Act money, experts like Wheeler remain hopeful that it might happen sooner rather than later. Seth Bodine, Harvest Public Media.
More children are testing positive for the coronavirus across the U.S., but a vaccine for children under 12 is still at least several months away. St. Louis Public Radio's Shayla Farzon asked a pediatrician, Delene Michalak, if unvaccinated children are at risk.
We know that kids a lot of times can carry the virus and not necessarily have symptoms. At this point, especially with the Delta variant, we've learned that it's just as contagious for kids as it is adults. Part of, I think, the reason why the numbers for kids wasn't as high, kids, we took them out of school, we started social distancing, things like that. So they really weren't together at that point when things got, you know, to the peak of the pandemic. But now we are seeing those numbers increase again with the Delta variant. And currently, again, according to the CDC, kids have made up about 14% of the cases of the COVID.
I'm glad that you bring up the Delta variant because it's driving some of these surges, these outbreaks. You know, should parents be concerned?
So as parents, you know, we should always be concerned and protective of our children. And I don't necessarily think it's a point to be fearful. And of course, we don't want to raise anxiety or fear in our children. But again, it's a reminder that we still need to continue to take those steps of wearing our masks, socially distancing, doing appropriate hand hygiene.
What are your thoughts on masking? Like, are there certain times or situations where kids who are unvaccinated should definitely be wearing a mask?
I think definitely when they're around other people, especially one, if they're going out back to school, we know school's getting ready to start again, or close quarters where we can't necessarily ask people if they're vaccinated or not. Now, if you're in a household where, you know, the parents are vaccinated, grandparents are vaccinated, those are places that it's safe. But if your kids are in, again, smaller area where more people are that you can't necessarily know their status, I would recommend that they go ahead and mask.
One thing that I wanted to talk about was gatherings. I'm hearing from some families that they would like to get together, you know, maybe have one of those like long-awaited family reunions that they've been putting off, but they're nervous because not all of the adults there will be vaccinated. Do you have any advice for parents who are trying to navigate this situation right now?
I think if families are wanting to get together, the best thing is, one, that is your family. So at least those are people who are approachable that you can ask for their vaccination status. And I feel overall, most people should be understanding, especially when kids are involved, that you want to be safer. And if it's limiting how many people come to that family gathering, or maybe doing it more so by location, that, you know, it isn't necessarily everybody in the family who meets up, and still including, you know, like a Zoom or, you know, some sort of virtual family members on there if they aren't vaccinated, not to be fearful of kind of standing up to make sure that everybody is safe.
Do we have any idea of when a vaccine could be approved or ready to go for children who are under 12?
So all the information out there right now seems to point more so at some point in winter that we'll have a vaccine for that age group. But of course, nothing's guaranteed at this point.
What would you say to a parent who's feeling conflicted about getting their child vaccinated?
Again, I think part of it is just being educated. And that's something, as a physician, I really try to do with my patients, is to ask them, you know, what questions do you have about the vaccine or vaccines? Why are you on the fence? Because most patients or parents, when they come in, really already overall have their minds made up as far as what they want and what they don't want. And my job, how I see it, is really to fill those gaps and answer those questions that haven't been answered yet. But I think the important part is that parents have all the information that they need so they can weigh everything out and decide what they feel is the best decision for themselves and their children.
That's St. Louis Public Radio's Shayla Farzan speaking with pediatrician Delaine Michalak. We've learned some new things about the Delta variant of COVID in recent days. It's as contagious as chickenpox, and vaccinated people could be spreading it. Linda Lutton talked with some people in the Chicago area to get their take.
I meet Jake and Christy from Des Moines, Iowa, in the River North area on Friday night. She's vaccinated, he's not.
There's not enough research on it for me.
As they've been walking around, outside or inside, they haven't been wearing masks.
Suggested. I mean, there's signs suggesting it, but no one's enforcing.
So will the Delta variant get them to change their minds or convince Jake to get vaccinated?
No. I think we're both comfortable.
Nearby, I meet Lori and Katie Abbey, mother and daughter from Kenosha, here celebrating a 13-year-old kid's birthday.
Navy Pier, the Museum of Science and Industry.
No one is vaccinated. Katie says she's had COVID twice. She's a nurse's assistant. I ask them about the guidance.
Vaccinated and unvaccinated over the age of 2, wear a mask when you're indoors.
I would just say that questions the authenticity of the actual vaccination in and of itself.
To Katie, this is one of the reasons she never got the shot.
It doesn't stop you from getting it. It doesn't stop you from spreading it.
So until it's more healthier, I feel like it's better just to wait until it's FDA approved. So I would say that didn't really change my opinion.
I don't think it changes anything.
The revelation that the Delta variant could be spreading among vaccinated people is a huge change from what we knew. But as I continue to talk to people, I'm struck that it might not be changing perspectives. It kind of feels like it's cementing them.
Yeah, nothing really has changed for me, at least, because I've always been wearing my mask, so.
Matthew Chen is wiping down tables outside the Chipotle restaurant where he works near Fox Valley Mall in Aurora. He's vaccinated.
Previously, when they enacted the you don't have to wear a mask if you're fully vaccinated, I personally, myself, still chose to wear a mask because I wasn't feeling that confident in everybody's status as being vaccinated.
Now there's a brand new sign on the Chipotle door that Chen appreciates, giving the new CDC guidance on indoor masking. But like many other customers at the Chipotle, Daniel Maida is ignoring it.
I can't keep changing my life for other people.
He's vaccinated, and if you're not...
That's like your own fault if you get sick, honestly. Like that's on you. We're at the point now that pretty much anybody that's over 12 can get vaccinated. If you're not vaccinated, that's almost a personal problem. I'm kind of over the point that I have to wear a mask for other people.
The Delta variant feels like it's upending a lot for Shannon Limjuko. She's at a parent rally nearby in support of masking in schools.
I'm feeling anxious and nervous because I have two young kids, so they're not eligible to be vaccinated. And I think we were all feeling so optimistic and positive going into the summer. I've had my kids doing soccer again. And just in the last week, I feel like as a parent, I'm starting to second guess.
It all feels like a step backwards when we had been moving forward. For some, it's just about acceptance.
We've been wearing masks for the better part of the year, so what's the difference? Griping about it isn't going to help.
Just be cautious and follow the rules. That's really it.
I meet these guys at another store. No sign on the door here. Both are vaccinated and masked.
It seems a little surrealistic at this point, but it'll come to an end. It's just taking longer because nobody wants to conform anymore. People are tired. People want to have freedom. So we'll get there.
Until then, he'll keep his mask on. He said he wants to be around to see the end of it all. Linda Lutton, WBEZ News.
A lot of teachers across Illinois this summer are using the time to shake off the stress of teaching during the pandemic. From taking long walks, traveling, even growing tomatoes, they've been spending the time recharging. Adriana Cardona-McGiga checked in with a few in Chicago.
I just did 12 miles in 2:45, which is damn fast for me.
Slay. Training for the Chicago Marathon is how Kali Jankovic, an elementary music teacher in North Suburban Waukegan, is decompressing.
I usually get here around 6:45. We didn't start about till 7:20.
Jankovic trains about four times a week with a group, usually by the lake, other times near Millennium Park. Running the marathon is something Jankovic, who's 36, has been wanting to do for several years. But she had an accident a few years back, and last year, when she was ready,
everything went to hell, of course.
The pandemic happened, and everything shut down. She couldn't see her students or sing with her choir.
It was really tough, just not having anything else to go off of.
Jankovic loves being around people.
Team to end AIDS, yes.
She's running the marathon to help people with AIDS, but she's also there to connect with others and be outdoors. The last two school years, she says, were intense and unpredictable. In the spring of 2020, only a few students would come to her music class.
I would have a Google Meet open. I would be sitting there on an empty screen for hours. And it was really hard, just feeling very disconnected.
When she was back in her classroom earlier this year, it was grueling. She had to juggle teaching kids remotely and in person. Jankovic was asked to teach summer school, but to that she said,
nope! I actually got a email the last day of school from one of the teacher supply companies, and it was, it's never too early to think about back to school. And I was like, yes, it is! Leave me alone for 1 week, please!
Aside from running, Jankovic is out at the symphony, at Grant Park, Ravinia, the museums.
Just getting to see people again after so long and trying to date a little bit and failing because I'm bad at that. I just did 12 miles.
Miles away from Jankovic in suburban Oaklawn on the southwest side, teacher Norm Brooks is recharging by practicing the trumpet. Brooks is a substitute teacher at the Boys Elementary on Chicago's south side. He played the trumpet as a kid, and then he picked it up again a few years ago when he was subbing at a high school.
And the music teacher and the students were actually helping me along with it, so I'm no Miles Davis, but I'm working on it.
Like many teachers, Brooks says last year was very challenging. He says the most stressful part was
keeping the students engaged. You have the students in class, you might have their attention, but now you done lost the attention of the students online, and vice versa. You got the students online attention.
Aside from playing the trumpet to recharge, he's also taking care of his grandson. He already introduced him to the trumpet.
But here was a song that I've been trying to play, been practicing. Let me see if I can see the notes.
Thank you. He's still learning, but he's determined to keep practicing. Brooks, who's only been teaching for a few years, is not scared of another uncertain year. He says he's looking forward to sharing his love for music with his students. For now, before school starts, his goal is to be able to hold a tune. And he says, why not? Maybe sound a little more like the famous trumpet player Chuck Mangione. Adriana Cardona Magigad, WBEC News.
We'll stick around. We have more of Statewide reports and conversations from in and around Illinois. That's on the way. Still ahead on Statewide, we'll talk about Illinois becoming a state. It wasn't a certainty at the time, and those pushing for it weren't always on the up and up. That story is on the way. Augustana College and a startup company are offering new transfer students guaranteed income for 5 years after graduation. Michelle O'Neill brings us this report from the Quad Cities.
Kent Barnes, vice president of external relations for the college, says a new company called Degree Insurance invited Augustana to participate in the pilot project.
The program guarantees a specific income level to the graduates in the 5 years following their graduation. The coverage levels are set at the median expected earnings by degree.
The new product is called American Dream Insurance. Wade Eyerly, CEO of Degree Insurance, says the company is offering coverage to 20 transfer students at no cost.
If this were, you know, if this was the massive success that we hope it will be, right, and a university wanted to buy it, the university is the buyer. There are two other potential buyers. The state could buy it on behalf of its students, or a nonprofit could buy it on behalf of the students, but this is not something that will be marketed to or sold to individual families or students.
A Forbes.com article says Degree Insurance opened last fall after raising $4 million in seed money. To qualify for Augustana's income insurance program, new transfer students must submit applications to attend the college in Rock Island by August 23rd. I'm Michelle O'Neill.
A Bloomington attorney and Lincoln scholar has given an 1854 letter Lincoln wrote to a Peoria attorney to the Abraham Lincoln Presidential Library and Museum in Springfield. He spoke more about it with Charlie Schlinker.
Guy Fraker says it's a window into the mind of Lincoln as a politician and a person in transition from the old Whig Party to the just-forming Republican Party. Fraker says Lincoln was seeking a U.S. Senate seat at the time. State legislatures chose senators through most of the 19th century.
Lincoln put his hat in the ring in the summer of 54. The election would take place officially in 55. It took 50 votes to win. He had 45 on the first ballot.
And yet he still didn't get the extra few.
He didn't. It went through 9 ballots, and that just slowly slipped away. The battle was between former Democrats who were anti-slavery now and former Whigs, was the other party, which included Lincoln, who are now anti-slavery. And this doesn't mean abolitionists. I make that clear. Abolitionists were radicals, and most people like Lincoln hated the institution of slavery, but they had their notions of how it should end. So Lincoln was running for the Senate. He had gotten elected sort of not really with his willingness, but the Whigs needed him. They wanted him in the legislature in 54. So he got elected to the legislature. So he was serving in the legislature, the very body that would select the next senator. Ian Powell was a lawyer that he'd associated with in the practice somewhat from Peoria, and he was a Whig and a political ally of Lincoln's. So he wrote Lincoln on November 16th of 54, advising him that under the new state constitution, which was passed in 48, people in the legislature were ineligible to be elected to the Senate. And Lincoln's response is my letter.
And what did Lincoln say to Powell about this little problem of electability here?
He thanked him for the advice. Powell advised him he better resign from the House of Representatives. And so he said, and I love this little twist that he added in there, acting on your advice and my own judgment, In other words, he wasn't willing to admit entirely that he didn't know that.
He blew it, yeah.
Yeah. If Powell hadn't written him, this whole thing would have been fouled up. Lincoln then resigned from the legislature so that he'd be eligible to run for the Senate. And then in the second part of the letter that I think is not as directly relevant to Lincoln's climb to the top, but I think it's every bit as interesting. He says things are reasonably well, except I may be asked to stand upon a platform I cannot support. You remember, this is at the time they were just literally dragging Lincoln over to the new party. He's always cautious about these things. So he wasn't ready to jump into the Republican Party yet. There was no, it was the anti-slavery party, the anti-Nebraska, they called it. He wasn't ready to quite to do that. And so that's when he said in this letter, I think it's fascinating, that he admitted that he was wrestling with this issue.
What did you think the first time you read that letter after you acquired it?
I must tell you, I was just sort of stunned. The thing that added to that, I got it home the night I acquired it and was just pleased as punch about having it, of course. But the onerous responsibility of having such a letter, in a sense, it's the most interesting Lincoln document he ever wrote.
And why is that?
It shows this snafu in the legislative race. But I think more to the point, to me, it's always been more fascinating to me that it shows his ambivalence in the fall of 54 and his slow movement over to join the new party, the anti-slavery party, which became the Republican Party.
And he was a full-on Republican by when?
By, I would say, 56. And that happened here in Bloomington when he gave the law speech, and it was the Republican nominating convention where he led the anti-slavery forces and gave what is called the law speech, which I think is one of the four speeches that put him in the White House. He assumed the leadership of the Republican Party.
What did Lincoln do when it became clear that his support was eroding and he wasn't going to get the Senate seat? Who did he end up supporting?
He supported the anti-slavery Democrats were supporting their candidate who was from Edwardsville, Illinois. Lyman Trumbull was his name. And Lincoln threw his support to Trumbull. The interesting thing is Trumbull's wife was the maid of honor at Lincoln's wedding. And where Lincoln resolved this dispute, if there was ever any bad feelings between them, he was supportive of Trumbull, and his sort of noble approach to this election that was so hotly contested didn't damage his relationships with anybody. Mary Lincoln never spoke to his wife, Julia Trumbull, again.
Lyman Trumbull became an ally of Lincoln later on during the Civil War, too.
Very much so. Very much so. This whole chain of events tells you so much about Lincoln. His realism as a politician, his flexibility, and his willing to work across, in this case, party lines.
That's Guy Fraker. He's a Bloomington attorney and lifelong Lincoln fan and scholar. He donated the Lincoln letter to the Presidential Library and Museum in Springfield. Fraker is also an author of the book Lincoln's Letter to the Presidency, The Eighth Judicial Circuit. It looks at the cases and the people Lincoln dealt with and how those political connections later helped him win the presidency. Fraker's donation to the Presidential Library spurred another, this one from future Governor Richard Yates in 1854, discussing his desire to run for the U.S. Senate, but wanting to avoid a showdown with Lincoln. Illinois now is the sixth most populous state, but there was a time when statehood was far from certain. Author Tara McClellan McAndrew wrote about how that changed with a bit of deception, and I spoke with her. Here is that interview. Tara, let's go back 200 years. I doubt most people today can comprehend that there would even be a doubt as to whether Illinois would be ready to be a state, but it was a much different place than what we know today.
It was a much different place. A little bit more than 200 years ago, we were a territory. We weren't a state, of course. And frankly, we were a bit of a backland. We were the Wild West. Illinois really became a state when it did because of one young, ambitious man named Daniel Pope Cook. He went to D.C. to seek a patronage job and was unsuccessful. And when he came back, kind of all of a sudden, he decides we need to be a state. Well, being a state means that there will be more opportunity for everyone, presumably him included. I talked with historian Sam Wheeler about Daniel Pope Cook's role in all of this.
He buys an interest in the first newspaper printed in the Illinois Territory, and that newspaper becomes his pulpit for advocating for statehood. And I also love this argument that Cook proposes in his newspaper. He says the Illinois Territory is destined for statehood, so why delay the inevitable?
So you focus on Daniel Cook. You also focus on Nathaniel Pope, a relative of his.
Daniel was Nathaniel's nephew. Nathaniel Pope was the Illinois Territory congressional rep who could not vote at that time because we were a territory. And Nathaniel Pope, as one historian told me, basically kind of gets this letter in the mail saying, hey, we decided we want to become a state, and so he just takes it under his wing, makes that his cause, and does some things in the process that work greatly to our advantage as a future state, and they get the job done, and they get it done pretty darn fast.
Well, slavery was still an issue in Illinois. A lot of people don't think of Illinois as a slave state, but back at that time, there were slaves living in Illinois.
Absolutely. And it was legal. And one of the problems in our territory becoming a state was that the law that ruled admission to the Union as a state, the Northwest Ordinance, forbid slavery. So what we had to do was tread a very fine line. We wanted to keep the settlers here, many who came from the South and had brought their slaves and were pro-slavery. We wanted to keep them here. We wanted to get more people here. How do we do that? How do we appease those folks and still toe the line with Northwest Ordinance, which forbids slavery? And we did that by framing our first state's constitution, which basically enabled both. The new state's constitution basically said, we will not allow future slavery, but the existing slaves can stay. It was a bit of wordplay, if you will, that opened the door for what became slavery in Illinois by another name, indentured servitude.
So Illinois becomes a state in 1818. About 40 years later, Abraham Lincoln is elected president, and you wrote that the way that the state's northern boundary was configured really helped ensure that Lincoln did win the presidency. Otherwise, he may never have risen to that level.
That is according to one man I interviewed, Frank Cicero Jr., who just wrote a book about this. And he looked at the vote totals that the Republican Party garnered up in the northern part of Illinois. Our boundaries were extended by our territorial congressional rep, Nathaniel Pope, before we became a state. When he applied to Congress and said, hey, we want to be a state, he also said the boundary should include the bottom half of Lake Michigan, so we would have access to what became Chicago. It wasn't at the time, of course. This opened up, as we now know, an enormous land for a lot of population, future population. And Frank Cicero Jr. has looked at the votes and the research and has said, if that boundary had not been extended by Nathaniel Pope, we may never have had Abraham Lincoln as our president.
Circling back to the decision to seek statehood in 1818, is it safe to say that the state then jumped the gun on this?
I think it is. Yeah, I do. First of all, there was no real call from the residents for us to gain statehood. And we didn't have the population. It's very clear. It's a pretty funny story, really, about how we frankly lied. We cooked the books. We were supposed to have 60,000 people. We didn't have near that. But we had to prove to Congress that we had 40,000. Frankly, we didn't have that. So one of the historians I interviewed was Illinois State Archives Director Dave Jones. He explains very well about how we handled that problem.
Nathaniel Pope, what he did, which was brilliant, was when you conduct a census, it's the federal government that conducts a census. He slipped into the bill that, hey, don't worry about it. Illinois will do the census for you. You guys are busy there in Washington. You don't want to take the time. We'll conduct the census. And the federal government bought it.
In many ways, we weren't ready, but we made it work, right? The Illinois way, we made it work.
But had they waited, and you've talked about some of the decisions made with the state's boundaries, is it safe to say had they waited too long, we might be a much smaller state today and a less powerful state?
You could probably make that argument. It's hard to say how long we would have had to wait to be less powerful, but certainly by starting this process as early as we did, we were in a position to grab land that ended up helping us enormously become a powerful state. And in retrospect, while it was premature, it served us very, very well.
That's the author Tara McClellan McAndrew, and you can find her article at our website, statewideshow.com. That's all the time we have for Statewide this week. Thanks for joining us, and be with us next time. We'll have more reports and conversations from in and around Illinois. Meanwhile, you can find our past shows at statewideshow.com, and our weekly podcast is available through the NPR One app. I'm Sean Crawford, and Statewide is a production of NPR Illinois with help from other Illinois Public Radio stations.